Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
Hey everyone, Amber here. I'm off this week, but I didn't want to leave your feed empty, so I decided to take last week's bonus episode, which was a little longer and connected to the Crippen case, and pull it out from behind the paywall. So this is something that Crimes of the Century subscribers have already had access to, but now I'm making it available for everyone. Hope you enjoy. I'll be back next week. There's a photograph of Norman Thorne standing in his chicken run, surrounded by his birds, hands on his hips, and a slight smile on his face. He looks pleasant enough. It's a nice picture. Truth is, though, if you didn't know the story of Norman Thorne, you wouldn't think much about the image. It's just an ordinary photo, maybe even a little boring. Except it isn't when you know what happened days later at that exact spot, the same patch of dirt where Thorne posed for the camera. That's where police took shovels to the ground and started to dig. What they found wasn't ordinary at all. Pieces of a 26-year-old woman named Elsie Cameron, dismembered and buried beneath the very chickens that had been pecking around Thorne's feet when the photo was taken. Thorne had a story for how she ended up there. He would tell it to police, and then to a courtroom, and then, eventually, to the hangman who'd put a noose around his neck. He said Elsie had killed herself, that he had found her hanging from a beam in his hut, that he panicked, and that what came after was the act of a frightened man trying to make a horror disappear, not the act of a murderer trying to cover his tracks. Some powerful people believed him. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, yes, the man who invented Sherlock Holmes, lived just up the road and said publicly he wasn't convinced the case against Thorne held up. But a jury in Lewis didn't need much convincing. They deliberated for a matter of minutes before deciding Norman Thorne was a killer. The question that's lingered for a century since is whether they were right, or whether one man's unshakable confidence in his own expertise sent an innocent man to the gallows. To understand what happened in that chicken run, you have to go back 4 years earlier to a Methodist chapel in Kensal Rise, London, where two Sunday school teachers struck up a friendship that would turn into something more. Norman Thorne was 18, an apprentice electrician with a tidy, unremarkable sort of decency about him. Elsie Cameron was 22, a shorthand typist, and by most accounts, she fell first and fell harder. They became engaged on Christmas Day, 1922. For a while, it looked like the ordinary beginning of an ordinary life. Then things started to come apart, slowly, in the way these things sometimes do. Norman lost his job and decided to gamble on something of his own. A small chicken farm in Crowborough, Sussex, bought with £100 borrowed from his father. He moved into a hut on the property, 12 feet by 7, barely large enough to stand up straight in, and started raising poultry. Elsie, devoted, made the trip out from London most weekends to see him. Meanwhile, Elsie's own life was falling apart in smaller, sadder ways. She lost one typing job, then another, and three positions in just 5 months, each ending the same way. Whatever was happening to her, her nerves, as it was described at the time, it was getting worse, not better. Marriage stopped being something she wanted and became something she needed, urgently, like a life raft. Norman, meanwhile, was failing at the one thing he had staked everything on. And the farm was deep in debt. Eggs weren't selling. He wasn't eager to set a wedding date when he could barely keep the chickens fed. And then, in the spring of 1924, he met someone else. Her name was Elizabeth Caldicott. Friends called her Bessie, and she was nothing like Elsie. She was young, easy, undemanding. She liked Norman for exactly who he was, and she asked for nothing more than that. Norman knew what he wanted now. He just didn't have the nerve to say it to Elsie's face. He sent her a letter instead, hinting at the affair, hoping she would be the one to end things first. She wasn't. In fact, by November of 1924, Elsie raised the stakes considerably. She wrote to Norman that she was pregnant and that they needed to marry before Christmas. But there was a problem with that claim. It wasn't true. Norman wouldn't know that for months, but what he did know is that while she told him she was pregnant, he knew he couldn't have been the father. He knew this because she and Norman had never slept together. It put Norman in a tough position, though. If he tried to deny it, who would believe him? I mean, they'd been engaged for more than a year, and while the societal expectation was for them to be chaste, unwed couples bent the rules all the time. If you were a man who slept with your fiancée, you were expected to marry her, especially if she were pregnant. And if you said, yeah, but the baby isn't mine, well, you were condemning a woman you had once loved to a life of shame. But Norman wasn't really moved. If anything, he dug in further, telling people around him that he intended to marry Bessie instead. And granted, he didn't have the chutzpah to say that to Elsie's face. He just kept waiting for Elsie to get sick of him being so wishy-washy and break up with him already. There was another complication, and it's the kind of detail that explains why Norman didn't simply walk away outright. When he had tried to end things with Elsie once before, her own sister warned him if he broke off the engagement, Elsie might kill herself. So Norman stayed engaged to a woman he no longer wanted to marry, dreading a conversation he didn't know how to have, while writing love letters to another woman entirely. It was, by any account, an unsustainable situation, and it was about to become a fatal one. By the autumn of 1924, the people who knew Elsie Cameron best were worried about her, urgently worried. A co-worker would later testify that on one of Elsie's last days at her typing job, she had had what amounted to a nervous collapse at her desk. She said her head was, quote-unquote, going funny. She had to be helped into the cloakroom while she fell apart. A colleague walked her home afterward, and on the way at Aldgate Railway Station, Elsie wandered toward the edge of the platform. The co-worker grabbed her and pulled her back. Elsie told her she felt like she was going mad. And this wasn't a one-off. The woman who rented Elsie a room during her visits to Crowborough described her as very strange and highly neurotic, someone who spent much of her time looking dazed, almost like she was in a trance. Even Norman's own father would later admit the engagement had troubled him from the start. He had seen Elsie's mood swing wildly, witnessed what he called her sudden outbursts of hysterical passion, and it unsettled him enough that he never gave his blessing to the union. So, this is who Elsie Cameron was by the fall of 1924, a 26-year-old woman, increasingly unstable, watching the one thing she had built her future around slip away from her in slow motion. On November 30th, the dam broke. Elsie showed up at the farm without warning, red-faced, shaking, furious. We don't know everything that was said in that confrontation, but we know it was loud, and we know it didn't end with a wedding date. Days later, Elsie wrote to Norman one more time. She told him she would be arriving on the afternoon of December 5th, and that she expected him, in her words, to do the quote-unquote decent thing. She packed everything she owned into a single bag and got on the train. After December 5th, Elsie Cameron basically disappears. She's not there anymore. Not in letters, not in photographs, not anywhere, except we would later learn, 6 feet under a chicken run, in pieces. Now for 5 days, nobody outside that farm knew anything was wrong. Then, on December 10th, Elsie's father sent Norman a telegram. Where was his daughter? She had left for Crowbro 5 days earlier and hadn't been heard from since. Norman's answer was immediate and clean. She had never arrived. He had no idea where she was. In fact, he had written to her himself, wondering the same thing. Soon after, Norman Thorne walked on his own into the Crowbro police station to ask if he had heard anything about his missing fiancée. And on Boxing Day, 3 weeks after Elsie boarded that train, he sat down with detectives and gave them a statement about the fiancée he had expected to visit, but who never arrived. Police believed him. Here was a concerned young man doing exactly what a worried fiancé should do, asking questions, offering what little he knew, cooperating fully. But then witnesses started to step forward. People who had seen her on December 5th walking through the very gate Norman Thorne swore she had never reached. That's when police took their shovels out. What officers found first was a bit curious. It was a suitcase buried in a vegetable patch. It was packed with the same belongings Elsie had carried onto the train. Proof that the woman who had never arrived had in fact arrived with all her worldly possessions. But the suitcase was only the beginning. The search moved on from the potato patch to the chicken run. And that's where everything Norman Thorne had told police fell apart completely. Everyone was shocked. I mean, for over a month, his story had held. He'd played his part perfectly and was quite convincing. And here was a young woman who had vanished without a trace en route to a fiancé who was telling people he was in love with another woman. He should have been the prime suspect from day one. But he instead walked into a police station voluntarily to ask if anyone had heard anything. Then he gave a statement. And even the most experienced detectives hadn't at first thought he was anything other than a worried beau. Even after the witnesses stepped forward saying, actually, we did see her on December 5th at Thorne's farm, police still weren't suspecting murder. Not until they started digging. In a tin on the property, officers turned up Elsie's watch, her bracelet, some jewelry, the kind of personal effects she wouldn't have left behind if she had walked away from her engagement. And of course, there's no innocent explanation for that buried stuff. The story Norman Thorne had been telling for the past several weeks was now sharing a hole in the ground with her belongings. Confronted with this, Thorne changed his story. For the first time, he admitted that Elsie had come to the farm on December 5th after all. She'd been upset, he said. She had refused to leave until they were married. He told her, finally, about his feelings for Bessie. They argued. And then, he said, he left her there. He had plans to meet Bessie and her mother at the train station, and he kept them, leaving his supposedly pregnant, furious, increasingly unstable fiancé alone in his hut while he went to see another woman whom he'd just announced he loved. When he came back, according to Thorne, he found Elsie dead, hanging from a beam by his own washing line. It's a story that asks you to believe a great deal. That a woman who had just delivered an ultimatum, who'd traveled hours with everything she owned to force a resolution, chose that exact afternoon in that exact hut to end her life rather than confront him further. That she did this with his washing line in the brief window he was gone. But the search wasn't finished. The dig on the chicken run, the one from the photograph, was about to get underway. What came out of that ground left no room for a simple suicide story. Elsie Cameron's body had been dismembered, cut into pieces, and buried beneath the chickens that had been pecking the ground for weeks. "Oh yeah," Thorne said. "Did I forget to mention I dismembered Elsie? Whoopsie. Yeah, that's a thing that happened." I mean, it's not like he could deny it, but he insisted it had nothing to do with how Elsie died. He said he saw Elsie hanging there and he panicked, alone in that hut with a body he didn't know how to explain, and then he made a series of horrific decisions in the hours that followed. Decisions born of fear, he said, not guilt. It's a meaningful distinction, if it's true. A man who panics and conceals a suicide is guilty of something. Bad judgment, of course, and worse under the law. But a man who panics and conceals a murder he committed? Well, that's something else entirely. So, which one was Norman Thorne? That question was about to be handed to the one person in England whose word, by 1925, was treated as close to gospel in a British courtroom. The pathologist, Sir Bernard Spilsbury.
Stop the podcast!
Stop the podcast!
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
The man called in to make sense of what was left of Elsie Cameron was, by 1925, the most trusted pathologist in England. Sir Bernard Spilsbury had built that trust case by case over more than a decade. He'd been the young forensic expert whose testimony helped send Dr. Crippen to the gallows in 1910. He'd gone on to anchor the prosecution in the Brides in the Bath murders, the Blazing Car case, trial after trial where his word, delivered with total, unhesitating confidence, tended to be the word the jury believed. By the time he walked into the Thorne case, he had been knighted for it. He was, in the eyes of British law, very nearly infallible. So when Spilsbury examined Elsie Cameron's remains and concluded she hadn't died by her own hand, that conclusion carried enormous weight before the jury had even heard a word of testimony. Now here's what he found, and here's what he argued it meant. Spilsbury found no bruising around Elsie's neck, nothing to suggest a rope or a ligature had been pulled tight enough to kill her. That's notable, since hanging tends to leave signatures on the skin, and by Spilsbury's account, that signature wasn't there. What he did find was bruising elsewhere, and pulped tissue, which he took as evidence of significant blunt force trauma. In Spilsbury's reading, someone had beaten Elsie Cameron, likely with a blunt object. An Indian club, kept on the farm, was floated as the probable weapon. And critically, Spilsbury testified that the dust on top of the beam in Thorne's hut, the beam Thorne claimed Elsie had used to hang herself, was undisturbed. No rope could have been tied there, he said, not recently, maybe not ever. Put together, that was Spilsbury's case. No hanging, because the beam showed no sign of one and the neck showed no sign of one either. Instead, blunt force, beating, murder. Norman Thorne's own account of that afternoon was held up against this. He said he and Elsie had argued. She had told him, falsely, that she was pregnant and demanded marriage. He left to cool off, he said, and to meet his other girlfriend, Bessie, and her mother at the train station. When he came back to the hut, he found Elsie hanging, but she wasn't dangling midair. Her feet still barely touched the floor. He said he cut her down, and then, in what he described as a state of frenzied madness, fearing he'd be blamed for her death regardless of how it happened, he dismembered her body and buried it in the Chicken Run. If true, Norman Thorne was guilty of something genuinely disturbing, panic, cowardice, the desecration of a body he should have reported, but not murder. The defense did not let Spilsbury version go unchallenged. Two defense pathologists took the stand to dispute his findings directly. One argued that Elsie's neck wasn't unmarred, as Spilsbury had said. Rather, there were marks that Spilsbury dismissed as natural creases. The bruising on her body, this pathologist argued, hadn't come from a beating at all. It had come from Thorne cutting her down after she died, her body falling, being handled and moved. Then there was a second defense pathologist, Dr. Hugh Miller Gault. He also went after the physical evidence. Spilsbury had described pulped tissue as proof of severe blunt trauma. Gault disagreed on technical grounds. In his professional experience, tissue doesn't pulp like that unless there's an accompanying broken bone, and there was no broken bone here. If Spilsbury's signature piece of evidence didn't match his own diagnostic logic, what exactly was the jury being asked to convict on? And there's a detail worth considering. Spilsbury told the jury that blood at the site was evidence a beating had occurred, but this was a working chicken farm. Blood from routine poultry slaughter wasn't an anomaly here. It was a Tuesday. That's not proof Thorne was innocent, but it's a contamination problem any rigorous investigation should have had to seriously rule out, and it's not clear the prosecution's case spent much time doing so. So here's where the jury found themselves. Three professional, credentialed pathologists looking at the same body and arriving at opposing conclusions. One said beaten to death, the other two said died first, cut down second, handled and dismembered after. Well, you might think, well, that's two against one, right? Surely the jury at least considered that the infallible Spilsbury might have erred, or at least decided there was enough doubt to put Thomas's guilt in question? Well, no, not quite. Before the jury ever retired to deliberate, there were already signs the playing field wasn't level. We'll start with Elsie's exhumation. When Elsie Cameron's body was dug up, Sir Bernard Spilsbury was the only qualified medical professional present. He conducted his examination, drew his conclusions, and that was that. The remains weren't preserved afterward for anyone else to independently study. So when the defense needed their own pathologists to examine the body, they couldn't examine what Spilsbury had examined. They were working from a second exhumation of a body that had spent the intervening weeks in a coffin that hadn't been properly sealed. 4 weeks of additional decomposition on top of whatever Spilsbury had already taken from the remains the first time around. This is, by any reasonable courtroom standard, not a fair fight. One side's expert got the freshest possible evidence. The other side's experts got what was left after a month of decay in a leaky coffin. And it didn't stop there. Spilsbury's trial testimony, delivered with his usual unwavering certainty, actually contradicted some of what he had said earlier at the inquest, and nobody challenged him on it. Not the defense, not the judge. No one in that courtroom seemed interested in asking why the great Sir Bernard's story had shifted. Then there was Justice Finlay. Throughout the trial, he referred to Spilsbury repeatedly as an eminent pathologist. The defense's experts got no such introduction, no comment on their credentials or their standing or their decades of professional experience. And when it came time to instruct the jury, Finley told them plainly that the tissue evidence was of decisive importance. A jury doesn't need to be told twice who to believe when the judge has already told them once. They deliberated for less than 30 minutes. Guilty. Norman Thorne was sentenced to death. After Norman Thorne's conviction, his lawyers appealed, arguing that the dispute between Spilsbury and the defense pathologist was a genuinely technical one, a kind of complex scientific disagreement an untrained jury had no real way to adjudicate on the merits, and that, lacking the tools to evaluate the science itself, the jury had simply trusted the more famous one. The appeal was dismissed. On April 22, 1925, Norman Thorne was hanged at Wandsworth Prison. It was Elsie Cameron's birthday. She would have turned 27. The night before he died, Thorne wrote a letter to his father. He knew, by then, that nothing was going to save him. The appeal had failed, the date was set, there was no more legal road left to walk. What he wrote wasn't a confession or a plea. It was something closer to a verdict of his own on the system that had convicted him. He wrote, quote, "Never mind, Dad. Don't worry. I am a martyr to Spilsburyism," end quote. It's a pretty striking phrase for a man writing just hours before his own execution. I mean, he basically looked at what happened to him and said, "Hey, this isn't really about me at all. It's about a system that's built up one man into something close to unquestionable." The letter made the newspapers within a day. And for a meaningful slice of the British public who had followed the trial closely, that phrase landed exactly the way Thorne probably intended. Not as the last words of a guilty man grasping for sympathy, but as a real question about whether the country had just hanged someone on the strength of one expert's reputation rather than the strength of the actual evidence. That question didn't go away when the trapdoor opened. If anything, it was just getting started. Norman Thorne's case wasn't an aberration. It was a pattern catching up with itself in public for the first time, where enough people were paying enough attention to notice. To understand how Spilsbury got to that courtroom in 1925 with the kind of unquestioned authority that could end a debate before it started, you have to understand how he operated for the two decades leading up to it. He worked alone, by design. He refused to train other pathologists. He didn't submit his methods to academic scrutiny or peer review. There was no second opinion built into his process because Spilsbury's process didn't include anyone else. And that wasn't a quirk of personality. It was the entire foundation of his reputation. If nobody else ever got close enough to his work to check it, nobody else was ever in a position to find any cracks. And the volume of work alone should have made that terrifying. By the 1930s, at the peak of his career, Spilsbury was conducting somewhere between 750 and 1,000 postmortem examinations a year. And that's two or three bodies a day, every day, for years. I know an amazing medical examiner who takes his time, is incredibly thorough, and still missed a bullet in a waterlogged man's neck a few years back. No one's infallible. Even the most brilliant pathologist alive doesn't move that fast without missing something. Keith Simpson, one of the pathologists who would eventually help dismantle the myth, put it plainly years later. Spilsbury's, quote, "strong evidence has doubtless resulted in conviction at trials that might have ended with sufficient doubt for acquittal," end quote. That's not a rival sniping from outside the profession. That's a fellow Home Office pathologist looking back at the body of work and concluding that Spilsbury's testimony likely sent people to prison, maybe even to the gallows, in cases where the actual evidence should have left room for doubt.
Stop the podcast!
Stop the podcast!
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording,
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watch The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
And what finally broke the spell wasn't one dramatic reversal. It was attrition, a new generation of pathologists who simply weren't willing to defer the way courts and juries had deferred for 20 years. Simpson, Sidney Smith, Francis Camps, men with their own credentials, their own postmortems, their own willingness to eventually say that Sir Bernard Spilsbury might be wrong. Of course, they didn't do that while he was alive. It was only after Spilsbury's death that the folks who succeeded him started saying what no one had been willing to say to his face, that he had probably gotten some people convicted who shouldn't have been. Still, even without some dramatic public reckoning, by the time Spilsbury reached his final years, the world had changed around him professionally. He wasn't the darling he had been at his peak. The press had moved on to newer pathologists with newer, more rigorous methods. Juries started truly weighing the differing testimonies of expert witnesses, not just accepting whatever the Home Office's man had concluded. The aura that had once made his word close to unimpeachable had thinned out, case by case, into something closer to one expert opinion among several. But the professional eclipse was only part of what caught up with him. The 1940s took almost everything else, too. His son Peter, a young doctor, was killed during the Blitz in 1940. Another son, Alan, died of tuberculosis in 1945, just after the war ended. His sister died. His marriage came apart. A stroke left him struggling to think clearly and to speak in court the way he once had. He was in his 70s, in declining health, increasingly broke, and increasingly alone. On the evening of December 17th, 1947, a hospital technician at University College passed Spilsbury's laboratory and smelled gas. When they got the door open, they found him on the floor, unconscious, with a Bunsen burner tap turned full on. He couldn't be revived. That would be too simple and not quite honest to call his death a referendum on his career, to say the man who had spent decades insisting he was never wrong finally ran out of road. For starters, he wasn't always wrong. There's a reason he was trusted to begin with, and he did real, lasting good for forensic science. The trouble was never that he lacked talent. It was that nobody, including him, ever built in a way to tell his good calls from his bad ones until it was too late to matter. The truth of his death seems sadder and more human than a career reckoning anyway. A man who had lost his children, his health, his marriage, his money, in a profession that had quietly moved past him. Whatever reckoning Spilsbury was having in that lab in his final years, it was almost certainly about more than Norman Thorne or any of the other men whose fates he'd helped decide. But it's also true that the system he operated in for 40 years never had to answer for those fates the way he did, in private, at the end of his own life. The juries who trusted him moved on. The judges who deferred to him moved on. Sir Bernard Spilsbury is the only person who ever really paid a personal price for what Spilsburyism cost, and even that price had very little to do with the people he was wrong about. Norman Thorne's case never entirely went away, it just went quiet for a while. It resurfaced, of all places, in a series designed to get reluctant readers back into the habit of picking up books. In 2006, the best-selling crime novelist Minette Walters was commissioned to write something short and fast-moving for a UK literacy initiative called Quick Reads, the kind of book meant to hook someone who hadn't finished a novel in years. She chose Thorne and Cameron's story, and the result was a slim novella called Chicken Feed. And to be clear, it's fiction. Walters wrote dramatized scenes, invented dialogue, built out the emotional texture of a relationship no one could honestly reconstruct from a 100-year-old trial transcript. It's a novelist's imagination filling in the gaps of a true story, not a historian's reassessment. But Walters didn't stop at the fiction. In her afterword, written in her own voice as herself, she said she doubted Elsie Cameron's death was actually murder at all. She suggested that Spilsbury's own assessment, the one the death sentence had rested on, was wrong. I mean, that's a novelist's opinion, not a forensic reexamination. It didn't carry the institutional weight of a DNA test or a peer-reviewed paper. But it's also not nothing. It's one more voice, decades after the fact, looking at the same disputed bruises and the same supposedly undisturbed beam, and arriving exactly where Norman Thorne's own letter to his father arrived the night before he died, convinced that the verdict said more about Spilsbury's reputation than about what actually happened to Elsie Cameron. And Walters is far from alone in that company, then or now. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle thought the case hadn't been proven beyond reasonable doubt, and said so while Thorne was still alive. The legal historians who've revisited the trial in the decades since have pointed to the same unevenness we've walked through here. One pathologist working from fresher evidence than the others, a judge who couldn't stop calling one expert imminent while saying nothing about the others who disagreed with him, a jury sent to deliberate with a thumb already on the scale. None of it proves Norman Thorne was innocent. This isn't a story that ends in a clean exoneration. It's entirely possible Thorne beat Elsie Cameron to death in a moment of rage and panic and then spent the rest of his life, right up to the gallows, lying about it with remarkable composure. People do that. Happens all the time. But entirely possible isn't supposed to be the standard. Beyond reasonable doubt is. Whether Norman Thorne was a murderer or a panicked, cowardly man who concealed the suicide, one thing isn't in dispute. The case against him leaned almost entirely on one man's word, delivered with a confidence the actual evidence may not have earned. To research this case, I drew primarily on the notable British Trials volume on the Thorne case, edited by retired judge Paul Worsley KC and published by Mango Books. The academic article Bruised Witness, Bernard Spilsbury and the Performance of Early 20th Century English Forensic Pathology, which sourced the martyr to Spilsburyism quote and the exhumation irregularities, the True Crime Library's account of the case, and the Crowborough News local history write-up. I also looked at contemporary news coverage of the case. Thanks, as always, for supporting Crimes of the Centuries as a subscriber.
Stop the podcast!
Stop the podcast!
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids, some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.